This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
For years, we have been told that most of the extra heat from our greenhouse gases goes into the sea. But what is happening there? I've written to experts around the world trying to get the big picture of marine warming. Crickets. Well, finally, we have a new paper published in the journal Nature, and it warns us about marine heat waves. The lead author is Eric J. Oliver. He earned his PhD in physical oceanography from Dalhousie University in Canada's Maritime Province of Nova Scotia. Eric has also been a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tasmania. Many of his co-authors are Australian, with more authors from the UK, particularly Scotland and the United States. From Halifax, Canada, Eric Oliver, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, as you know, on land, a heat wave is pretty relative. People in the UK think they're cooking at 28 C or 82 Fahrenheit. That's just another day in Pakistan. So how do you define a marine heat wave?
Well, you make a really good point that what is or isn't a heat wave, what isn't extreme, is relative to what's normal in a particular region. So that is exactly what has informed the basis of our definition of marine heat wave. So we have a qualitative way of defining what is a marine heat wave. That is to say, it's a prolonged period of time where water temperatures are anomalously warm relative to what is expected at that time of year. And then we can further quantify that, which is what we did in this study, to say that a marine heat wave is triggered when water temperatures are higher than the 90th percentile for a particular time of year, and that persists for at least 5 days. And what the 90th percentile means is that it's a temperature that you would expect 9 days out of 10 to be less than. So 1 day out of 10 is that hot or hotter. And so if that temperature is exceeded for 5 whole days in a row, at least, then we've entered a marine heat wave state. And because that percentile calculation is dependent on the actual variability of temperature, that scales by region. So in somewhere like the tropics, where there's not a lot of variability of temperature, the percentile allows us to trigger a heat wave when it's only maybe 1 or 2 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures, because that is quite extreme in the tropics. Whereas here, say off the east coast of Canada, the water temperatures are really variable. That might not be triggered until it's 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer than average.
And what got you looking into this, and why has this information been so hard to find?
In 2011, there was a marine heat wave that occurred off the west coast of Australia. And while these kind of extreme temperature events in the ocean have happened before, and certainly to a large degree are evident in the natural world, this one gained a lot of attention because it was so extreme. It was the coastal temperature loggers measured 5 degrees warmer than average in the middle of summer. And offshore measurements recorded by satellites said 6 to 7 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures. And this event persisted for an entire month. So it was oceanographically and climatically really interesting and anomalous, but also there were impacts on ecosystems. So there were fish that were found out of range, there were fishery closures because of temperature sensitivity and things like abalone. And there were, the most interesting to me is the kelp forest ecosystem collapsed under the temperature stress, and there was a rise in the seagrass ecosystems in its place. And in fact, that change from kelp to seagrass has persisted since the event in 2011. So this event that came along caused an impact, and then the event went away, but the impact remained. That kind of ability of a transient event to permanently affect the system really shocked people, and it was quite interesting, let's say, from a scientific perspective. So a researcher based at the University of Western Australia, Professor Thomas Wernberg, brought together a few people to lead this working group on marine heat waves. So himself, Dan Smale, who's based in the UK, Marine Biological Association, myself and Professor Neil Holbrook. Neil is still, and I was at the University of Tasmania at the time, the four of us led this workshop that was held in Perth, Western Australia, in 2015. And we brought together a total of 15 researchers from around the world, from all those countries you mentioned at the beginning. And we cut across three main fields of expertise. We had climate scientists with a lot of experience in extremes. We had physical oceanographers, and we had the marine ecologists. And we got together for 3 days and it's often hard to speak the same language when you've got a physical person and a biological person trying to talk about the same thing. We often, even the same words can mean different things. But if you're in the same room trying to have this conversation over a few days, you get there. And that's what we were able to do. And the outcome of this workshop was that we ended up with three lines of research that we would then scatter or back around the world and pursue. And one of them was actually, how do you define a heat wave, which is how we came up with that definition that was published in 2016. And one of the other lines of research was, what can we say about the global record of marine heat waves? What's the global distribution like, and are there any long-term trends happening? The expectation being that there might be, given the kind of long-term warming we've been seeing in the ocean and the atmosphere for the last, well, decades to centuries.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the paper, I have to say, like, if fish run short due to marine heat waves, that can start minor battles between countries. It can threaten protein sources for millions of people. So this is a very important topic, and I'm surprised there haven't been more studies on this before.
Well, that's a really good point. And I think, I mean, there are a couple points to make about that. One is that there have been studies on marine heat waves. If you look up marine heat wave on Google Scholar, say, if you just type in the keywords, there's been essentially an exponential increase in that term being used. In the past, certainly people would have talked about sea surface temperature extremes or temperature anomalies, things like that. Certainly El Nino, that happens in the tropical eastern Pacific, you could characterize that as a marine heat wave. It's a period of time, quite prolonged, where water temperatures are very high. In 2003, there was an event in the Mediterranean, and that was published. They didn't use the term marine heat wave, but it fits very much into our framework. So people have been looking at these. But I would say that the difference between what happens in the ocean and what happens on land or in the atmosphere over land is that it's so much harder to see what goes on in the ocean. So when we have a heat wave on land, the most obvious impact is that humans feel stressed. We get hot. We don't want to do very much. We're sweaty. But we also see that, well, animals get stressed out. In Australia, for example, they have flying foxes, which is like a large kind of bat, that once air temperatures reach 42 degrees, they just fall out of the trees that they hang on while they sleep. So the impacts are much more obvious in the atmosphere, whereas in the ocean, if you're a fisherman or if you're an ecologist who's out there interacting with the ocean regularly, then you can see that things are changing, although maybe you don't actually know that the water temperatures change unless you're measuring it. And the rest of us just kind of notice, oh, the beach is warmer today. So I would say that these events in the ocean are more hidden, so it's easier for them to go by unnoticed.
It recently hit the news that a swordfish was seen off the coast of British Columbia, and we also have seen more of the big tropical sunfish. So some surprising things are happening out there. We also had the blob, that this big pool of hot water that hung off the North Pacific, off the coast of Washington State and British Columbia for quite some time. Is that part of what you're studying?
Exactly. That is another example of a marine heat wave. That is a pretty interesting one because it was so persistent. A lot of these events that blink on and off around the world tend to be on the scale of maybe a few weeks to a few months, whereas that event persisted for something like two or more than 2 years. But it does nonetheless fit into our framework of what we think of as a marine heat wave, a prolonged period of anomalously high ocean temperatures. And it had the same kind of impacts. There were range extensions of different kinds of fish. There were fishery closures, marine mammal strandings, I believe, toxic algal bloom outbreaks. That one was interesting, though, because it actually fed back on the atmosphere, right, and affected weather patterns over Western North America.
It did, and I lived through it. Now, in your study, you talk about comparing periods starting around 1925 and moving up towards the present. How can we possibly know what the sea surface temperatures were in the 1920s or 30s?
Well, ships have been out measuring them, basically. But the longer answer to that question is that getting the right data sources and pulling the data together in the right way was a big part of that study, and I'd say one of the big successes of the study. So to define a marine heat wave, we really need daily measurements, fairly high-frequency measurements of temperature. And we were interested in doing this globally. So we needed this information globally. And that kind of information really has only been available since the early 1980s, since satellites have been recording surface ocean temperatures daily. However, we were able to supplement that data with two other sources of data. So one would be daily measurements, not global, but at a few sites around the world where they have recorded temperatures for a very long time, 100 years and more in some cases. Places like the lighthouses in BC, for example. There's a few stations along the west coast of the U.S. and some in Europe. These are just examples where over 100 years ago, someone decided we need to start recording temperatures, and they would go out to the shore with a bucket, literally, and measure it, or measure it off the end of the pier. And that has persisted until now. So we have these truly invaluable records of ocean temperatures, in situ coastal ocean temperatures. But that's not global. A third data set that we have that is global are analyses and amalgamations of data that would be recorded from ships that have been going around the oceans for hundreds of years, really. Ships have always been recording ocean temperatures. And these are more infrequent, and there are products that take these data and grid them and provide them in regular packages. And that can effectively give us global monthly measurements of temperature. So we have these three data sources: satellites, a few stations, and these ship-based records that can each have their own strength, whether it's daily, global, or long-term. And we're able to effectively borrow the strengths of each data set together to construct this record of marine heat waves going back to, we went back to 1900.
So, in the period from 1925 to 2016, did the frequency of heat waves increase?
It did. So our results show that there was a statistically significant increase in the frequency of marine heat waves, and we define frequency to mean the number of events that happen on average per year as a global average. So it's very average, but we're taking a global picture, and the data is showing us that in the early part of the 20th century, there were little over two events that would happen per year. Whereas in the latter part of the record, so basically the last 30 years or so, that's increased to, in very recent years, up to four events per year, but on average, something like three events per year. I think that's a 34% increase, if I remember the number from the paper correctly.
And what about the duration? What did you find there? How long they last?
Similarly, so we defined this average duration, which is to say, you have so many events occurring per year. How long are they on average? Some events can be quite a bit longer. Some are shorter. But on average, in the early 20th century, they were about 10 days long. Whereas in the last 30 years, they've lengthened out to up to 14 days long.
So we're getting more of them, and they're lasting longer. This sounds serious.
Correct, yeah. And while thinking about frequency and duration, it can be a bit confusing maybe to think about that in a simple way. So an easier way is actually just to think of, well, how many days per year are part of a marine heat wave, or how many marine heat wave days are there per year? How many days are ecosystems going to be exposed to extreme temperatures? So if you have a certain number of events per year and they have a certain duration, then you have a certain number of days that are part of those heat waves. And that number has increased by 50% over the time period that we examined. So it's something like 30-ish days on average per year in the early 20th century, and that's increased up to around 40, 45.
Now, we have natural cycles that you do talk about in the paper, like La Niña and El Niño and those sort of things. I'd like to leave those aside for a minute and zero in on what is the background sea surface warming trend, which, according to the paper, is 0.16 degrees C per decade. If that's true, one would think that over the past 100 years, the sea surface would have warmed by about 1.6 degrees C, and that is actually greater than what is reported for land warming.
Well, we do know, actually, that the ocean is a huge reservoir for a lot of the warming that's happening around the globe. So in a way, it's unfortunate that the impacts are so hidden and our attentions are diverted away from the ocean, because a lot of change that's happening in recent decades is happening in the ocean.
And it must take a massive amount of energy to increase the sea surface temperature at all.
Yes, I imagine it would do, yes.
And it's going to release that slowly, that heat. The whole ocean is going to release that heat again very slowly over centuries or longer. I've also encountered, along talking with various scientists, that there will become a point where the ocean ceases to become such an effective heat sink for our greenhouse gases. It should slow down their absorption rate, and then we get whatever we put into the atmosphere will come back on us much quicker, but I guess that's outside the boundaries of this study, is it?
Yeah, that's a longer timescale thing, but it's something that we need to be cognizant of when we're thinking about this. Because so what's going on there is that when we think about the oceans warming, we're often thinking about, well, it's the surface ocean that's warming. And there are certain areas around the globe where that surface water is convected down to the deeper parts of the ocean. So the North Atlantic is one area, or all around the Southern Ocean is another area. And this process is a fundamental part of the global climate system. You can think of it crudely as a conveyor belt. Maybe you've heard the global conveyor belt terminology in the past. So this is, for example, in the Atlantic, you have warm water brought north near the surface. In the higher latitudes, it cools and is made more dense and drops to the deep. And the time scale for which that water stays in the deep before it comes back up to the ocean surface is something like 1,000 or thousands of years. So now we're at the beginning of that process where the earlier tracks of that global conveyor belt, let's say, have this warmer water that's newly warmed because we've been warming the climate system over the last one and a half centuries. But as we continue to warm it and as it continues to pull it down, it's going to fill up that conveyor belt with the warm water. And once it's filled up, then it won't have that capacity to keep to store it away anymore effectively.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With me is Canadian ocean scientist Dr. Eric Oliver. We are discussing his new paper, Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. Eric, let's talk about what is happening in different parts of the world. Why don't we start with the region where you live, the Maritime Provinces of Canada, and of course, New England. What does your study show there?
Well, we didn't focus very much on the regional impacts, actually, in our study. We were trying to elucidate what's the global average trend, really, to make more bulk statements. But you can look at what the changes are regionally, and certainly on the long time scale of 115 years, effectively, almost the entire ocean is experiencing these positive trends in the marine heat wave properties that we looked at. There's really only a few places where we don't see increases in the marine heat wave properties, and that really maps onto regions where we don't see strong increases in ocean temperatures. The biggest, the most conspicuous region being the far North Atlantic, and this has been noted before. There's what they've called a global warming hole in the high latitudes in the North Atlantic, where it actually appears to be cooling, or not warming at all, certainly on a 100-year time scale or so. And the consensus, as I understand it, that's emerging now is that this is being related to a slowdown in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which is one of the limbs of this conveyor belt I was talking about. It's that part of the North Atlantic that brings warm water or brings surface water down to the deep.
I didn't see any discussion in the paper of the actual Arctic Ocean. Is that why?
No, and that's because we excluded regions that had ice cover for longer than 5 days, which is most areas that have any kind of regular occurrence of ice. And that was mainly for statistical reasons, because we didn't want, because of the definition of a heat wave having to last for at least 5 days, it would have interfered with our ability to calculate heat waves. But that being said, it's obviously very important to look in those regions, in the Arctic and around the Southern Ocean as well. And now that I'm based back here in Canada and interested in these higher latitudes, I think it's something that I will be looking into pretty soon.
Yeah, we just had news of an ocean heat wave in the Tasman Sea between Australia and New Zealand, and I know you were working in Australia. What are marine scientists saying there, and how much is this part of the great threat to the Great Barrier Reef?
So what happens in the Tasman Sea and around southeastern Australia, I would say, is decoupled from what happens in the Great Barrier Reef, in the sense of the specific drivers of those events, not talking about global climate change. What happens around Tasmania is really, really interesting, because Tasmania is a cool water ecosystem generally. So we have a lot of cool water species that have refuge there because much of the waters around Australia are much warmer. But unlike, say, here in North America, where if waters tend to warm, the cold water species might just migrate further north, in Australia, you don't have any higher latitudes, actually. So Tasmania is as cold as you get, and then you've got 3,000 kilometers of Southern Ocean before you find Antarctica. So when things happen there, when the waters are warming there, it can have really detrimental impacts. And they're losing things like their giant kelp forests, and a lot of their fisheries and aquaculture systems are under stress.
And when it comes to the long-term viability of at-risk ecosystems like coral or the food fisheries, or as you mentioned, why do you think heat waves matter even more than the gradual increase of mean sea surface temperature?
Well, I'd say they both matter. The key is that when an impact happens, generally, that's not because the mean has warmed. That's because an extreme has occurred, an extreme event has occurred, that extreme event sitting on top of the mean, which may have warmed, but the extreme event has occurred that's pushed something over some kind of a threshold. So really, it's the extremes that we feel. In the summertime, maybe, let's just say for the sake of argument, that this summer is 1 degree warmer than a typical summer 30 or 40 years ago, you're not really going to feel the difference between 25 and 24, say. But that extra degree can push the frequency of the more extreme events, those heat waves that are up in the 30s, that extra 1 degree can push the frequency of those extremes up in a way that you do feel them. And that's the same thing for marine heat waves. So the mean is important, but we feel the extremes, I guess, is the way to phrase that.
And just the idea of marine heat waves stimulates so many new fields of research. I think we could look, for example, at the effect on algae blooms. I've talked to experts on plankton, and they say, well, we don't really know how this is going to go, whether it will increase or decrease with global warming. And then we have the whole idea of marine heat interacting with storms. We know a hotter ocean can drive bigger hurricanes. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I think this is exactly the list that you put there, and I could add more. It's it opens up a very broad range of topics to study. And the thing I find exciting about it is that it opens up these topics that have cross-disciplinary aspects. So you listed a few that would mean physical and climate scientists working alongside ecologists or fishery scientists or working alongside hurricane researchers and forecasters and things like that. And that's one of the things I find it very exciting about it. It has this sort of cross-disciplinary impact.
I realize science really reports on the past, but what are your thoughts, Eric, about the future of marine heat waves as global warming continues?
That's a really good question. So in our study, we showed that the rising marine heat wave metrics were primarily driven by the rising mean ocean temperatures. So effectively, the global warming of the oceans is what is driving this increased frequency and duration of the marine heat waves. And while we didn't demonstrate in our study, we can rely on other published works that have effectively shown that global warming of the oceans is an anthropogenic signal. And so therefore, the rising trends that we see are predominantly driven by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And so the next step then is to exactly what you say. How is this going to continue into the future? How do we expect these trends to go throughout the rest of the 21st century? And that's actually what we're working on now. And to do that, we need to turn to models. We actually, obviously, we don't know what it's going to be like in 20, 30, 40 years, but we have fairly sophisticated and very good computer models for the climate system, for the oceans. And so we can use these models to simulate a projected future state of the ocean under different kinds of emission scenarios to tell us what we might expect the future state of the oceans to look like and the future state of marine heat waves. I will say that regardless of what those results show specifically, and that's work in progress, so I can't give you any numbers, it is the case that regardless of how we change our emissions, I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions globally, the climate system has so much inertia in it now from the emissions that we've put in the system that it's not going to stop. It's not going to start cooling right away. So even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases right now, it's going to continue warming for at least the next few decades. And so we can expect these trends to continue regardless of what we do, at least for the near future.
Is there anybody responsible for watching out for marine heat waves? I mean, do we even have a real-time marine heat wave reporting system?
Not really, and that's something that needs to be or it would be great if it was tackled. In the tropics, I would say that they've been looking at extreme ocean temperatures and thinking about these for much longer than, say, the mid-latitudes or the higher latitudes. And they are certainly aware of extreme temperatures in the tropics because of its impact on coral. So there are some programs like Coral Reef Watch that's run out of NOAA that does exactly what you're saying. They have real-time monitoring of ocean temperatures across the tropics, but it's not more broad than that. It doesn't function for the mid-latitude regions. So that's something that it will be really good to implement, both real-time, but also hooking this definition of what a marine heat wave is into our forecast systems, because we have seasonal forecast systems that can give us some confidence about ocean temperatures 2, 3, 4, 6 months from now.
I didn't know that, and it would be interesting to see ocean forecasts. And one last question, and I don't want to be too dramatic here, but is there a possibility we'll get to the point of unexpected disasters for marine life due to a marine heat wave?
Well, I think we've actually already seen that in some regions. I mean, that kelp forest collapse being replaced by seagrass meadows on the west coast of Australia was absolutely unexpected. And I don't think it's been so disastrous for humans, but I think it was quite disastrous for some of the marine creatures living there. In 2012, there was one of these events that occurred here off the east coast of Canada and the U.S., and water temperatures in the spring were very high, anomalously high, and this caused the lobster fishery to unexpectedly have a massive increase in the number of landings earlier than usual. So the lobsters flooded, the industry flooded the system, and there was a unexpected drop in price, and there were a whole range of downstream effects on that, which led to economic and political tensions between Canada and the U.S. So I would say we're already seeing little hints of these kind of tensions and unexpected consequences arising.
We have been talking with Dr. Eric Oliver about the totally underreported phenomenon of marine heat waves. Eric and 14 other scientists from around the world have released an important new study in Nature Communications. The title is Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. You can find links to the paper and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.